Welcome to the TFT podcast. I'm Matt. That's Ryan. Hi, Ryan.
I'm the kind of guy that buses splash with rain, Matt. I'm very sad.
Ryan, just because I'm a certain age doesn't mean I'm any older than I was yesterday. And if you don't know what those are references to, let me set the table conceptually for you. The loss of a beloved pet can be a devastating trauma to anyone who has ever endured it. You know, I remember when our family dog died. I was weirdly uptight about emotions at the time. I was maybe like 13 or 14 and wanted to like be grown up and like not get real upset about stuff. But like secretly, I was very upset when our family dog, who, you know, my parents had had since before I was born, died. So we're going to do an episode that's about the trauma of losing a pet.
Well, and it's about a lot of other things.
No, we're talking about Frankie Kosmos, first major label. Well, first sort of, is it a major label?
Well, but it's more major than, it's major.
Let's call it first non-DIY release, right?
Well, it's a first, and I'm not even sure, it's the most major label release. She may have had a few things that were released on other labels, and it's hard because it's not even. I mean, I think one of the things that we're going to talk a lot about is the levels of doing it yourself,
right?
So this is an album. So I think here's the way,
we haven't said the name yet. The album's called Zentropy, and
yes,
it's available at all the streaming services. So like we usually tell you, if you haven't listened to it, put us on pause, go play Zentropy. Zentropy by Frankie Kosmos, and 20 minutes later come back and listen to the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, this is one where we will easily double, if not triple, the length of the material that we're discussing.
I was driving around LA a lot today, and I listened to Zentropy like 3.5 times in a row while I was preparing today.
And so I think the way to describe it, and the way it's described on her Bandcamp, which is ingridsuperstar.bandcamp.com, and we have the link in the show notes, and the whole album is streaming there as well. It's described as her first studio album, right? So I think that it's definitely, and what you were getting at, Matt, is so kind of again to set the biographical context a little more, and we have some of the other secondary sources in the show notes. Frankie Kosmos is the recording name of Greta Klein, and she has previously recorded under the name Ingrid Superstar, and. You know, part of why it's worth distinguishing Zentropy from the rest of what she's done is that she's released a tremendous number of recordings on her Bandcamp, again, which is was started when she was recording under Ingrid Superstar. It's, you know, well upwards of 40 releases in the last 3 years or so. And it's really interesting. I mean, it raises a lot of questions of what is a release in the age of digital releases. But these are all things where there is a, you know, there are albums insofar as we've been kind of using albums as a conceptual unit in this, in TFT,
right?
Because they are partitioned from each other. They have a title, they have art, and they are a collection of songs that are under that umbrella, and released at a different time. But they're also, very, I think one way to think of a lot of these is as sketches, as short sketches of songs, or really of you know, poems given melody and accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think there's actually some overlap, and I think I'm just, you know, well, we can return to this if and when we want to, that actually shares a lot with some of the earliest kind of the pre All Hail West Texas Mountain Goats output and some of the songs on All Hail West Texas. And so again, there may be some other. So this album is still DIY, and it's still and you know that the songs are written herself and kind of you know recorded by a small group of people, and it's on an album. It's released on a label. Which is a very small, which would be called a DIY label, a double double whammy, and that it's a small group of, you know, it's not a by any means a corporate label. It's you know a you know she is friends with the label, and the label is most likely run out of somebody's apartment or basement or artist's loft. Or something of that sort. But again, what sets this apart from the rest of the output is that it's recorded in a studio. Some of the songs have choruses that come back, but you know, none of them are longer than 2 minutes and 30 seconds long. And so even though if there is slightly more development, more instrumentation, better microphones as you know, or microphones as opposed to the ones that are built into a MacBook. You know that's kind of where this is. So that's I think I don't know any other kind of prologue or things that we want to set up, because almost as we're setting some of the conceptual space, we're setting up the playing field that we are going to run wild over.
Yeah, I want to just throw up a couple things, balls that I'd like to keep us in the air. One is that like I actually think like living room to studio is a continuum more than it is a binary.
Yeah.
You know, you're either living room or studio, right? Like, because what happens when you plug a microphone into the MacBook? I mean, an expensive microphone, right? Like,
yeah, right. Well, like right now, where I mean, let's put it this way: I'm a little more historically, you know, listeners who are part of the TFT 100 club will know that I've been historically a little more living room, and Matt's been a little more studio.
Sure.
Even though we are both sitting in you know various rooms in our domiciles,
right?
And that's because Matt, you know, has a very nice microphone.
Yeah, shelled out.
And I'm a jerk.
Yeah, well, you've been sounding good. You've been sounding good recently. I don't know.
I know it was around like episode maybe 80 or so was the first fully TFT studio album.
And we still haven't passed the Bechdel test yet, though, so that's fine. But let's keep that in mind. The other thing is I'm haunted by the specter of Kitty, right? Like all the time when I'm thinking about Frankie Kosmos. And I want to keep Kitty in mind sort of as a figure, as a foil for Frankie Kosmos, as someone who comes from the outer edges of the Cremaster field of authority and influence, right? Rather than being from the center.
And I think that the other piece of this, and that you know, and you know, Frankie Kosmos is from the center in two ways. One is that she's you know based in New York City,
right?
But then beyond that, she has famous parents, and is the daughter of, particularly as you may have surmised from the last name, the daughter of Kevin Kline and Phoebe Cates, right?
Yes. So she right, and that and like we have, I think, intentionally buried the lead on that fact. The way it's not mentioned until like pretty deep in the Pitchfork interview with her that we've been looking at, and I sort of wonder about that as a rhetorical strategy, right? Like, I think it's an achievement not to get Pitchfork to lead with that, you know?
Totally. I think that's definitely the case. And I think we'll circle back on that, but it also sets up as one other kind of figure to kind of haunt this album is Taylor Momsen.
Uh-huh.
And the Pretty Reckless, right? And that, you know, a lot of that episode that we discussed last week of the album Going to Hell was really about kind of being a child actor and growing up in that world and transitioning to music from that. And I think that you know, the relationship of having famous parents and famous parents who are based in New York, I think, is something that's there. So I think we have a lot of Yeah, we have a lot of. I'm imagining kind of we've set up a conceptual slalom. Basically, we've put up all of our flags, and now we're going to go go tearing down the slope of our minds.
Yep.
As we go forward.
Well, good. So let's go wild. And I hear, Ryan, that art school makes you wild.
Yeah. Well, I think that. That's interesting. I think that. People who go to art school are always already wild. and it's hard, right? So we're going to have some trouble doing some of our lyrical close readings because, in fact, most of these songs don't have transcribed lyrics online. And so we're going by memory more so than usual. The first song is called Art School, and talks about kind of school as the thing that's making you go crazy. And I guess the other, if we're putting up one other flag, is that she is Greta Klein, the artist known as Frankie Cosmos, I believe is a freshman at NYU, and so is a recent high school graduate, still probably a actual effing teenager, and certainly when she started the project was deep in the throes of teenagehood, and that's yeah. So yeah,
when she started the project, you mean this record or her sort of, because she is extraordinarily prolific, and if you look on her Bandcamp, like that discography goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah. And I think as we kind of approach this, you know, Matt, you know, I've been giving you as many swings at it as you want, so I'm just going to go ahead and ask you. This Frankie Cosmos.
I was all ready to talk, right? Like,
this Frankie Cosmos. I think you in kind of starting what art school makes you do. I think really makes me want to ask a question. Well. You know, this Frankie Cosmos with her art school and her buses splashing her with rain and her dancing in the public eye, is she for real?
Yes, I think.
Ooh, that hesitation is very telling.
No, but yes, I think she is for real, but the hesitation is she's real for certain definitions of real.
Matt, there was definitely a dog, and now his body is definitely gone. I mean, does it get more real than that?
Do I think that she's sincere? Mm. Yes, probably. Right? Do I think it's real in the sense that these songs are even though the production on Zentropy is a little more involved than, you know, just hitting play in GarageBand, as on the previous records, like, do I think these songs are sort of immediate in the way you talked about Mountain Goats, All Hail West Texas being immediate in terms of, like, a very short period of time separating the conception of the song from the permanent record of it? I think so. Is it at certain points affected? Yeah, it seems like it, right? Because it's not. I mean, look, I don't want to talk about what anybody's life is like, and I'm sure it's very difficult being the daughter of two famous actors in certain ways, but. There is a claim to a kind of hardship, right? A kind of almost pathological shyness or loserdom or lonerdom that I think is not being made of Greta Klein herself, but is being made about the character of Frankie, right? And in that sense. I suppose it's not for real because there is a character sort of intervening between right between the character and the experience of listening to the songs.
But then I think that understanding the character of Frankie Cosmos is actually really important as we approach this, because then to take it one step further, then, you know, because I think that a lot of the the baggage of authenticity in indie music is the presumption of, well, is this authentic, you know, if it is, you know. You know, again, if it is, you know, we've talked about a number of the dimensions and continue on which something is judged to be authentic or to be indie, to be independent. And we've talked a lot about, you know, kind of immediacy and intermediation versus intermediation in the process of producing something. We talk about kind of sincerity in intent. And I think that, you know, the creation of persona is an interesting one, because I think that, you know, there in some corners of indiedom, of especially in the kind of singer-songwriter space or the emo space or certain kinds of classical indie pop, and the one that of the sort that that Frankie Cosmos gets compared to, and this, like, particularly the band that she gets referred to a lot, compared to a lot, is a band called Beat Happening, that was in the 80s and 90s, really a major kind of force in kind of indie pop, and in even in sensibilities that are described as twee, or kind of cute and childish, and I think that in these kinds of other, you know, kind of classic indie pop or kind of twee indie pop or emo or singer songwriterdom, there is a sense of not only am I going from the song to the recording, or from conception to recording, but that what that is pouring out of me, and that it is a journal put to song. And I guess, I mean, here's like a question. If we're kind of, though, viewing this as a, you know, when we talked about mountain goats, and actually, you know, several things that we've been talking about the realness of lately, actually, like many of the last few things we've talked about, of All Hail West Texas or Born to Run or Betty Davis, was, you know, the ways in which they were real cohabited with the creation of fiction in some way, whether it's the kind of the almost epic poetry of Springsteen's, yep, New Jersey, or the story anthology of All Hail West Texas, or the kind of almost, you know, character performance monologues of Betty Davis. You know, I think that, I guess the question is, how do you approach, you know, authenticity or realness when something is kind of, you know, is being described as is self. So I think here's an interesting question of, what do we make of the claim of this to be poetry, and to be, I think there's a lot in both the work itself and in the framing, you know, that tries to align itself with poetry, right? And that, you know, even in the song "Sad" too, that I referenced, right? The kind of opening lines are, "He was just a dog. Now his body's gone. So what is left but me and my poem?" And there's, I think, a few other places where poetry is referenced. Again, most notably in the name Frankie Cosmos, actually, at least, you know, in interviews, is ascribed to a reverence for the poet Frank O'Hara. And so, I mean, what do you? You know, as someone who's studied poetry and poetics, even.
I've studied poetics. I think English 990, darling. It was
what? What
lovely,
do you make of this? Of this claim, and it's, you know, with respect to our research question.
Sure. I mean, look, a lot of the word lyric, right?
is the same as lyric poetry, right? And mm-hmm. and it's called that to distinguish it from epic poetry. It's mm-hmm. It's, you know, generally shorter. It's generally concerned with the a much more kind of everyday or observational or, you know, smaller scale set of issues than epic poetry is. You know, it is generally focused on sort of individuals and individual experiences rather than on the kind of the great movements of history and of societies, right? And a lot of, you know, early songs very often come to us in the form of like, you know, a text printed on a page, you know, and so the idea of sort of lyric and song lyrics being two separate things is I think a more recent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And that originally it was sort of all of a piece. And the music, you could have sort of different settings of lyric, poems. You could have sort of different settings. So, you know, but I think that song lyrics are, often always already poetry, but not always, right? Like, or not always poetry, I guess, that it's worth abstracting out from the from the music and considering in isolation, right? The best lyric has kind of a verbal music of its own, whether or not it's set to a tune, and that's not always the case of a lot of pop song lyrics. I have a suspicion that it reflects the writing process. That is to say, I'll bet these things get written down on paper first, and then sort of tunified. Tunified later.
I think it also may also reflect, and we, you know, we talk, you know, the songs set out worlds, you know, the world of being in art school and in high school, right? In the song, she talks about both art school and high school, and talks about, you know, being in New York. And I think there is a lot here that's about being a, you know, a teenager in New York and being kind of. And I mean, it's interesting. I think that part of what I kind of get from this album, from her body of work in general, is that, you know, that she is someone that doesn't exist in the Gossip Girl world, right? She kind of lives in a Gossip Girl liminal space because she's of a. I mean, I guess if anything, crazily, she's still more like a Humphrey. Because
she's Vanessa or something like that, right?
Yeah. Exactly. She's Vanessa, or I think, I mean, again, you know, the Humphreys, you know, Rufus being, having, you know, let's not forget, even though like Rufus is like portrayed as Pory McPoorpants, he was a successful musician, right, in the 1990s, and is a freaking gallery owner,
right.
In the narrative.
And in the book, so, in the books, by the way, he's a poetry editor in the West 90s.
Right, exactly. And so let's put it this way. I mean, if Greta Klein were to go to high school at Constant Billers, she would definitely be a Humphrey, right? Like, she would definitely be treated as, oh yes, her parents are actors, and then there'd be like, you know, some Blair quip about French kiss. Like, that's the only French kissing that she'll be doing. or something like that.
Sure.
And so I think that.
But there's
what I was going to say is that in this kind of, and we can have interrogate her in the Gossip Girl sphere. But what I was going to say is that there is a concern that of, you know, having been being a teenager and having been recently in high school, of, you know, part of why making a claim to poetry, and I think also there's also claims made both in these songs and in the presentation to art, to visual art, and to painting, of, in addition to it reflecting process, I think there's also a desire to be the kind of person who writes poems and who likes poems, and being the kind of person person who likes art and likes making art. And in, you know, this is even in, and I think just the, you know, the a concern with the kind of person that you are is really nicely in the lyrics for Buses Splash with Rain.
Sure.
Of she says, I'm, you know, not even I, you know, she doesn't say I was splashed with rain by a bus you know, the buses did this, but I am the kind of girl.
Right.
The buses splash with rain, and I think that, you know, that we
and
can
that's,
even
that's interesting because it doesn't actually have to even really ever happen to in order to belong to the category of girls that buses splash with rain.
Yeah, yeah, right? Exactly. And so it's like it's a very interesting claim to make, and it is like a kind of an interest talking about, you know. You know, that girl, I was splashed with rain, but that's not me. I mean, it's engaging in these kinds of, you know, this kind of poetic engagement with self and identity that that we saw Brian Wilson doing. And it's kind of all the more impressive that is being done by, you know, you know, this is happening relatively early in her career. That, you know, Brian Wilson kind of reached some of these moments of reflection, you know, and after, you know, well into, like, let's say when he was, you know, 19 or 20 or a couple of years into his career, he was still surf safariing. Right. And so there's a, you know, and it's tempting to use words like precocious or things like that. I mean, it's interesting because there's also on other songs concerns about being pretentious. Right. And about not appearing pretentious. And I think that all of these concerns are of a piece, right? That of both being the kind of person who likes poetry, but not wanting, but also then being aware that that is like maybe making, you know, you want to look a certain way, but then are afraid of looking that way. Uh-huh. In the same way, right? Yeah. And what you want the positives of that without the negatives.
Sure. That's, yeah. Right. And that, like, sort of this, I think that this is a consequence of sort of being at the center of the Cremaster field, right?
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, Kitty out in Florida working at Claire's, right? Like, doesn't have to worry about the curation of identity at quite the level that, that Frankie Kosmos does, right? Like that, or it, at least it's not as much of a concern in at least the early stuff. If you're,
yeah, that it becomes a concern. You know, that evolves in real time with attention.
Well, let me refine that. It involves a real time proportionally with your conviction that your thoughts and feelings are of consequence to the world.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
And
there's something about living, like, I grew up in the middle of LA and I went to a fancy private school where a lot of Hollywood people went to. And we had the sense that, like, what we were doing was the most important thing in the world, right? It wasn't like, oh, when is real life going to start? You know, when is, like, I mean, of course there's that because you're growing up, but it wasn't like, oh God, life is happening out there in the big city, right? Like, novelists wrote novels about my school, right? Like, every couple years, it's the subject of a big think piece in Vanity Fair. When our film teacher retired, it was A1 above the fold news on the Los Angeles Times, the front page of the news section, right? Like, we had, and I don't know if that's saying that, like, the media landscape in LA is fucked up or that the milieu I grew up in was fucked up, but, like, we had this sense.
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. It is an Ouroboros of fucked upness.
Right. We had this sense that, that what we do, what we say, these things are of consequence. Growing up in this sort of in the center of something sort of undesirable, and that was a tough thing to unlearn as an adult, right? Like, the journey of my 20s was the journey of nobody gives a fuck about me, and there's actually a certain amount of beauty in that. But I think that the idea, the one of the differences between Frankie Kosmos and between someone like Kitty, and I'm using Kitty as a stand-in for a whole sort of class of 15, 16, 17-year-olds making music on their computers and releasing it on Bandcamp or SoundCloud or whatever, doing whatever awesome thing they do. The difference between them is that Frankie Kosmos sort of believes that... Or at least it's we're sort of given to understand that this material is consequential, right? Yeah. Like, it's important. It's important that you understand that I don't want to be pretentious. I just don't like to dance, or I'm not in the mood, or whatever. Right. When we're dancing in the public eye, right?
Kitty's earliest stuff is recorded in a way as if no one will hear it.
Right.
That it's more like a live journal in some ways. And even her Tumblr, right, is much more of a live journal. And obviously some people read your live journal, but it's people who you are going to interact with.
Yeah, there's some uncomfortable personal stuff. I actually like reading it. I've kind of come to admire her. I think, I think that kid has a, I think that kid's going places, but,
What was I going to say? I think that it's really interesting that what you describe actually relates, we talk a lot about, different forms of power and of kind of socially constructed power. And one that we haven't talked about a whole lot is something I actually think about and work on in some of my current projects and that some students that I work with work on that are kind of the psychological dimensions of power. The concept that's related to this is one of efficacy. So in psychology and social psychology and in some of the other social sciences, the idea of efficacy is the idea that you can do something, that something you do can make a difference. And so this might be self-efficacy, the ability of what it is that you can do and accomplish. It may be and a lot of what I look at collective efficacy, or the sense of that a community can accomplish a task, and the relationship between these senses of collective efficacy and engagement in collective action. And then people in political science look at political efficacy and the sense that a vote will make a difference, that you can affect the political process. And I think that this sense of efficacy, of being able to make a difference, is a tremendous dimension of power and of the related concept of empowerment.
Right.
Of what and that a lot of studies of international development, a lot of projects that purport to empower communities, empower individuals in developing country contexts, empower poor people, do not address these deeper sense of what people feel they can or cannot do, and I think that sense of when you, and that takes time to work on, and there's different ways to foster it, but having it fostered from a very young age and having it built in to an educational system or to one's family life is a tremendous way to have that kind of power and that kind of empowerment.
And that, by the way, what you're saying is the reason that the TFT project, or that is to say having someone with a background in political science and someone with a background in literature talk to each other, why that that's a good project, because the idea that the sort of the black and white real world quantifiable outcomes are related to the representational business of your conception of self and mm-hmm. your representation of self and how you project that in into the world in your culture's art, right? Like
yeah.
that's a link that I think, you know, we are forging, and that sort of probably needs to be forged more in the literature.
No, I think that's right, because then it links again to a lot of the concerns of this project of, you know, part of why we gravitated towards teen soap operas in the first, you know, stretch of our history is that it focuses on, you know, a lot of times these, this representation of self and the ability, one's ability to feel that they can kind of control that happens in adolescence. And so that adolescence is an important place to look to understand the ways in which society empowers and disempowers, in which there is, in which power structures are reproduced, and in which there are possible ruptures.
Right. And who has access to that in Gossip Girl?
Exactly.
I mean, like, I'm sorry, I just want to ring the changes. Hold that thought. Yeah. In Friday Night Lights, a football game, there's generally like a high degree of efficacy. You think that if you practice and work hard, your team can win, right?
And again, a lot of the story of that, especially of season one, is Matt Saracen building personal efficacy.
Yep.
And actually, much of the arc of the whole season is him learning that he can do things. And,
right.
and it takes 5 years.
Sure. Right. Yeah. It's and then in Misfits, there's a deliberate tension between superpower efficacy and social marginality.
Yeah. No, exactly. And these things kind of, you know, and that actually shows, right, that – well, right. I mean, right, that Misfits is actually really – and we didn't totally think of it in this light. Maybe it was. It would be interesting to go back and listen to those episodes that – especially – you know, we recorded some of them together and some with Tim Swan. That, you know, getting powers – doesn't necessarily mean that you're empowered.
Right.
And I think that the fact that, that Misfits uses superpowers really highlights these different dimensions of
right.
power and powerlessness.
So, but I interrupted you. I don't want to derail wherever you were headed before.
Oh, it's done. The deal. I think what I was going to. No, yeah. I've got it. What I was just going to say was, and then in the stretch of pop music, as you say, I think that a lot of why we've really fixated on these margins between so-called, you know, notionally indie music and notionally pop music is because there are a lot of attempts to kind of express self and engage in discourses that are empowering in the kind of deep sense that I'm talking about, that are building efficacy either individually or collectively, and discourses that are trying to dismantle that, and they're not always what you think they are. That is, things that are so-called indie these days are often, and in some of the cases that we found, are just as disempowering and counterproductive as things that purport to be popular, right? And so that and that's even kind of where some of the ideas of the Ouroboros is coming from, is that and that we've tried to find a few different ways to break down these binaries, either by saying these things, the thing itself is created and is reproducing, or that there are things that appear to be binaries are actually continuous and hyper-dimensional.
Right.
And I think that, you know, that makes it hard to kind of keep track of, but trying to basically bounce our way around this continuous and hyper-dimensional space is our way of trying to, both understand and honestly, I'll say, you know, empower, like, and kind of, you know, at least kind of, you know, and you know, because we through whatever reason, whether, you know, through your high school or really for me, college was the moment where I became convinced that what I had to say the world needed to hear, and then graduate school certainly doesn't help with that.
Doesn't disabuse you of that notion.
Right, exactly. So for me, the rude awakening is really coming more in my late 20s and 30s. But I think that, you know, that yeah, and it relates to the broader project, not only of TFT, but of overthinking it as well.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I like what you say about having a progressive social project of empowerment on TFT. It makes all the swearing and the alienation and confounding of our listeners seem like it has a kind of an ennobling purpose, you know, behind it.
And I believe that in a way. And I mean, it's really interesting that it makes me. I referenced this earlier, but it part of why it came to mind is that it reminds me of something I was just reading earlier today about K Records, and we'll link this in the show notes. And that you know, K Records is one of these early kind of do-it-yourself, you know, like local scene labels from the, you know, that really popped up in the independent music space in the 80s. And K Records was founded in 1982 in Olympia, Washington. So K Records is the hub of the Olympia, Washington scene. And I think we'll circle back to them and some of their artists and influence when we start talking about, when we move back to our historical stretch, because they're really important in the 90s. But that the K Records motto is exploding the teenage underground into passionate revolt against the corporate ogre since 1982. And it's really interesting that, and then, you know, in terms of linking this to a mission of kind of confounding the audience that, you know, Beat Happening, we'll throw some links to maybe a Beat Happening video or song or two in the show notes that, you know, melodically, well, I mean, especially compared to Zentropy, a lot of Beat Happening's output, Zentropy sounds like Born to Run by comparison, especially the early Beat Happening. And I think a lot of Frankie Cosmos's earlier output and the Bandcamp output shares even more in common with Beat Happening, which was a three-piece band, two vocalists. They were known for kind of all playing all of the instruments, but in a very kind of very minimalist beginner way. It's not that they were all equally bad at all the instruments, but they're all being equally good at all of the instruments, and that all, a lot of the vocals and you know the songs were very simple, and they're very childlike, and they often toured with punk bands. Many of the other labels of which K Records was as a peer were you know what would scan as punk, and so that when they played with Fugazi, which was one of the flagship bands of Discord Records, which is a DC based hardcore punk label. You know, that them coming out and playing these, you know, by comparison, quiet and simple songs about Indian summers and holding hands and things like that, you know, this itself was tremendously confounding and tremendously alienating for their audience members, and so it, you know, the most punk thing that you can do at a punk show is sing a sensitive song about like eating strawberries, and I think that is, and I think that we do identify with that that spirit, and I guess what part of why I'm bringing this up and to kind of connect back to Frankie Cosmos is I think that there's something interesting. You know, we were contrasting Frankie Cosmos with Kitty, but I think there's also an interesting, you know, that Frankie Cosmos is in you know the do-it-yourself space, both because she was recording these songs herself, but that also because the the label that that she's on is one that kind of takes its inspiration from things like K Records, and that she has played at and even volunteered as a high schooler, as a teenager, volunteered at one of New York's do-it-yourself venues, this semi-legal place called the Silent Barn, that was formerly in kind of, I guess, where Bushwick becomes Queens again, and now is just in Bushwick in Brooklyn. And I think that, I guess what I would like to say is, and this circles back to some of our previous questions, what does it mean for someone who has a, a by all accounts, pretty good family life by in New York, good and or comfortable family life, and with what appear to be supportive and fun parents. What does it mean to do it yourself? And this is not necessarily trying to be unfair.
No, we're not trying to shit on Frankie Kosmos. I like this record. I hope that comes across.
But I think it raises a question, and I've and I ask this as much from having temporarily given housing to a pair of Boston-based do-it-yourself artists, college-age artists, musical artists who happen to be part of my extended family. That on the one hand, one can do it yourself. It's easy to do it yourself when you're not paying rent.
Sure.
and having seen some of the kids doing it themselves these days. I mean, I was myself, a baby when the other when people like Calvin Johnson or Ian MacKay of Discord were doing it themselves.
Uh-huh.
But it seems like, I don't know, has doing it yourself changed?
Yeah. I mean, these fecund teenagers, prolific teenagers. Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I think that what you're pointing to is the sort of complication of the great man theory of history, right? Like, is this sort of is a nail in the coffin of the great man theory of history, right? Like, it's the myth that you are sort of isolated from influence, from context, from social milieu, from a larger economic discourse about the provision of resources, and that you sort of artistically stand completely aside from that, is a very seductive myth to have about artists, as though they went to, as though they shut the door and did their art thing in a Faraday cage that couldn't get any radio signals from the outside world, you know? And that's not the case. It's never been the case. As austere
and a Faraday cage that is just self-funded, right? A self-funded Faraday cage.
Exactly. Right. If in the apocalypse, it's going to take a lot of collective action to pile up all the desks and chairs from all the office buildings to make the giant bonfire when we take over and bring down the corporate world around our ears, right?
I'm the kind of girl that the zombie neuromancers splash with rain.
So we talked a little bit last time about I mentioned the sort of move from in English literary studies, the move from the New Criticism, a sort of post World War I critical school that was interested in dealing with a poem kind of as a work of art isolated without anything, as though it did not have tentacles out into the world at all, as though there were no commerce, as it were, between the work and the world, as though it was this sort of carved piece of stone that kind of sat there on a pedestal that you could examine, a system of tensions that you could elucidate, but that really sort of made nothing happen. Poetry makes nothing happen. The famous line from Auden, into a more post-structural view that
that either engages other texts or in the school known as sort of the new historicism engages history and has sort of tendrils out into history, and history has sort of tendrils out into the work. And so I read, you know, when I was more current on this sort of stuff, I read some criticism of Chaucer that was basically a political economy of late medieval England, right? And
put that in the show.
I'm not even sure I could find it. It's probably in a course packet or something like that. And that you know, and sort of dealing with, you know, Chaucer's sort of social project in terms of depicting a whole society. I mean, that's something that sort of literature does in these like travel stories. John Ford's Stagecoach is another one that leaps immediately to mind, where you put a representation of society in a little bubble, whether it's a stagecoach in the Western or a pilgrimage to Canterbury, and the sort of economic relationships between these people and the sort of economic implications of some of the statements that they make, or why they might make those statements given what their history is likely to have been at the time, turns out to be a pretty important thing to understanding Chaucer. Now this is the long way around the barn to say that do it yourself, right, has always been a myth, right? DIY is always already bullshit. Because what about the Taiwanese child making 3 cents a day to screw the, you know, to screw the little tension arms into John Darnielle's cassette recorder, right? Like, has that person not subsidized your work?
Right,
somehow?
Or the person putting together the the MacBook Pro,
or the guy mining the coltan, right, mm-hmm. under the lash of brutal oppression,
and civil war.
Right, exactly. Does this, you know, you can't.
he's the guy, he's the kind of guy that gorillas occasionally strafe with machine gun fire.
He's the kind, whether or not that particular guy actually gets strafed with machine gun fire, right? You know, and he is the kind of guy, right? And like, it's dispiriting to say. I'm sorry, we've gone from empowering to like really depressing, but your DIY, your like Faraday cage of like DIY non-interference, right, rests atop a pyramid of human skulls. And you can't get away from that once you start examining it. So I think that it's most, the DIY thing is mostly interesting as a rhetorical position.
I think that what is cool, and maybe this will be a good place to close, is that it's definitely I want to be really clear actually that I don't think that Frankie Cosmos is guilty of this, is as guilty of this as like 99% of the contemporary DIY space.
Sure.
And I think in part because there is, you know, a lot of self-awareness and doubt there, and I think that, you know, to kind of hammer home something that I like to say a lot, but I haven't actually, and I don't know if I've said on this podcast, is that listen, like feeling awkward and unhappy and weird and everything like that is not a first world problem. It's a human problem, right. and that having to curate your identity and represent yourself and express yourself is not, you know, that's the kind of thing, you know, that I'm the kind of girl that buses splash with rain is something that I imagine some a snarky listener would say. You know, hashtag first world problems. I have gotten splashed by rain in both Sierra Leone and Kenya.
Right.
And again, it wasn't. I'm not the kind of guy. I'm. I'm only the kind of guy that got splashed by rain, in that I was the kind of guy walking on a street in Kenya or Sierra Leone, and that there are problems that are human problems. And I think that, you know,
yeah,
that,
or by the way, I mean, obviously you've spent a lot more time as a non-tourist,
yes,
in Kenya and Sierra Leone, but like I went as a tourist to Kenya once, and crossing the border from Kenya to Tanzania, when you're set upon by people who want to like sell you things and begging and, you know, all kinds of stuff, it's this sort of raucous gauntlet that you run between the safety of your van and the safety of the customs office. One particular guy who was, you know, on this circuit, once he saw that I was like a 16 or 17 year old American teenager at the time, asked me, like, just desisted from you know, trying to sell his red striped blankets, and asked if I had any American magazines that I was done with, because he wanted the American magazines. And you know why he wanted them? Tumblr. Right? He wanted to rip out the pictures and reblog them, you know, by like passing
Absolutely.
Them around to his friends, right? So it's not, I mean, it's a first world tool, but it's a, and we're all first world tools, Ryan, let's admit it. But it's a human problem, absolutely. And, the other thing,
and again, I think that, and there is a project then, and so, you know, and I think it's this really damaging kind of rhetorical move to invalidate something because it doesn't attempt to solve the deeper human problems, of deeper human problems, both of, you know, these problems of identity and trying to make sense of the world, and the deeper human problems of inequality and suffering and oppression. And that is like actually, in some ways, possibly one of these potential tools of power, because then it invalidates all forms of expression.
Sure.
And the goal is to find ways to build efficacy, and to build that kind of confidence and opportunity to create. And I think that that's what's really inspiring and awesome about the Frankie Kosmos you know, record, is that it's a record that makes me want to write songs. It makes me want to reflect. It's really inspiring in that way. And I think that
it's also, you know, it's also good, like on a qualitative level.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Like, because there's a bunch of stuff that gets made like this that's crappy. But like, and we're not a review site. We're not a review show, because I think there are a lot more interesting things to talk about than whether or not you like something or I like something, right? But there is a subjective kind of quality to these things, and things that are good, you know, are good.
I mean, the songs are earworms. They get stuck in your head. These are the kinds of songs that get stuck in my head.
All right. Well, if this is the kind of podcast that makes that is empowering for you and makes you want to hold forth, you can do that with us on Twitter and in the comments on the show notes. And both on Twitter and in the comments on the show notes, I don't mean to be overly sentimental, but I think Ryan and I have both been like a little touched by moved a bit by like people who are into this show we do. So thank you very much for listening and for talking with us. We like talking with you about this stuff. We like talking with each other about this stuff. We just like talking about this about this stuff. So you can do that in the comments on Overthinking It, or by following us on Twitter and tweeting at us at TFT Podcast. We will like almost always have a conversation with you that usually involves both of us and several like dedicated listeners as well, who we rope in for various things. So if you want to chat with us informally day to day, TFT Podcast is the place to do that. We're going to be back with more next week. So till then, thanks for listening. It's been real.